Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Inside the Beltway conference call. And at this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Mr. Fred Reich. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. Good morning to many of you, and good afternoon to those of you on the East Coast. This is our 11th Inside the Beltway call, and since they're quarterly, that means we've been at it for almost 3 years, and we really appreciate your support. We have about 800 people registered for this program, and so it's continuing to be a great success. I'm going to be one of the speakers today. I'm Fred Reich. I'm the chair of the Financial Services ERISA team at Brinker Biddle, meaning that I focus on the issues of service providers and investments as they deal with retirement plans, including 401k plans. Also with me is Jim Dolan from NatPixis. I'll get back to Jim in a minute, but I do want to thank them for their support for these programs. The other main speaker is going to be Brad Campbell, and Brad is with the Washington, D.C. office of Brinker Biddle. I'm in L.A. Brad, as most of you all know, is the former Assistant Secretary of the Employee Benefits Security Administration, or as Brad knows that I tend to say, he was the Phyllis Borzy before Phyllis Borzy. So Brad and I are going to be the co-speakers. As the operator mentioned, the recording, this program is being recorded. In a couple of days, it'll be posted on the firm's website, www.drinkerbiddle.com. And there's a tab there that says resources, and you'll click on that. But give us a couple of days first. Also, don't even worry about what I just said, because we're also going to email everybody who registered for the program with a link to the recording. So you will be getting an email in a few days that has a link. And if you want to listen to the program again, or if you want to refer some of your associates to the program, you'll be able to do so. And we're going to go through the different topics that were in the announcement that you all received. And then at the end, we're going to allow a little bit of time for questions and answers. Having said that, let me turn it over for a minute to Jim to talk to you a little bit about NatPixis and their cooperation with us in putting on this program. Jim?
Thanks so much, Fred. As Fred said, my name is Jim Dolan. I'm with NatPixis Global Asset Management. We're excited to continue to bring you these calls and appreciate you taking the time to call in and listen to the call. And also, Brad, thanks so much for participating. This has been really insightful and informative, and we're glad to have been able to do it for the past 3 years. For those of you who aren't familiar with NatPixis, our mission is to help people lead better financial lives. And we do this through a process called durable portfolio construction. We provide access to over 20 specialized investment managers. I'd invite you to take a look at our website, natixisfunds.com, to learn more about our investment options, our focus on retirement. So again, thank you very much for joining us today. Fred, Brad, thank you for the partnership, and I look forward to the call.
And Jim, vice versa, thank you so much. Well, everybody, let's just jump into the deep end of the pool. Let's start off by talking about the fiduciary rule, which might better be described as a proposed fiduciary package. That package was sent over from the Department of Labor to the Office of Management and Budget for review on February 23rd, suggesting that about 3 months later, so that's March, April, May, the 20th or 30th, somewhere in there, roughly in that time frame, we should see the package for the first time. Now, the reason I call it a package is because there's really two distinct parts of it. Actually, there are more, but two for today's call. The first is the fiduciary standard of care, and the second is the prohibited transaction rules and proposed exemptions that will be in that package. And following up on the fact that we should see it around the 20th or so of May. I've gone on Twitter this year, so if you want to, I'll be issuing some early information on it as soon as it comes out on Twitter, so if you want to connect with me in that way, and also on LinkedIn. As I said, there are two parts, the fiduciary standard of care and the prohibited transactions part. Also, I want to point out that this is not a new rule. In the sense that there is a regulation under both the Internal Revenue Code and ERISA that was adopted in 1975. So this is an amendment to a 1975 regulation or a proposed amendment to a 1975 regulation. The amendment will, as the original or existing regulation does, apply both to ERISA plans through the through as a regulation under Title I of ERISA, but it also applies to IRAs and retirement plans as an amendment to the Internal Revenue Code regulation, which is verbatim identical. The two are identically worded. There's a difference, though, in the sense that under ERISA, the definition of fiduciary it contains a standard of care that fiduciaries have to abide by. But under the Internal Revenue Code, the definition of fiduciary only serves one purpose, and that is the term fiduciary is used in some of the privative transaction rules. It defines that. It is not a standard of care. Instead, the standard of care for IRAs, which would be regulated only by the Internal Revenue Code, not by ERISA, is either the federal or state securities laws or insurance laws or other laws governing the conduct of people making recommendations. It's, in other words, the fiduciary standard of care would only apply to ERISA plans. And for the purposes of advisors who may be listening into this call, the fiduciary standard of care for you has three primary prongs to it. The first is that a fiduciary must act solely in the interest of participants. In other words, he's got to put the interests of the participants ahead of his or her own interests. Secondly, the advisor has to act for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits and paying only reasonable expenses. So the objective is well defined, providing benefits and paying no more than reasonable expenses. And then the third is that a fiduciary advisor must engage in a prudent process to develop his or her investment recommendations. Those are all qualitative standards, if you will. They're not bright line tests, but rather they're behavioral standards about the quality and the focus of the work. And I think for the most part, people would generally agree with them. That's not to say everybody, but I think most people would. And so you have to walk away from this feeling that the idea of a standard that has those three requirements isn't enough to justify the huge controversy that's going on out there over the fiduciary package. Well, that leads to the second question. If it's not enough in and of itself, if the fiduciary standard of care isn't enough to generate the huge controversy, why do we have this controversy that's going on right now? Well, that's because not of the fiduciary part of the package, although a little bit there, but mainly it's because of the prohibited transaction part of the consequences of being labeled a fiduciary. Having said that, let me turn it over to Brad to talk about the prohibited transaction rules and the potential exemptions. Brad?
Well, thanks, Fred, and thanks, Jim, and of course, again, thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen to us as we walk through all these fascinating issues. But I think Fred said it very well. The issue here is much less about the fiduciary standard of care and the notion of, well, how did you develop your recommendations? What's the quality of your advice? What's the process you used? It really boils down to how can you get paid and how can you not get paid, and that has to do with the prohibited transaction rules. And I think it's important to divide this into three separate issues when we look at why, as Fred was saying, why has this been such a controversial rulemaking process. One issue is, who's a fiduciary with respect to advising a retirement plan? And that's a pretty clear, straightforward exercise. The other two are a little more surprising, perhaps, to some advisors I've spoken to, which is that, as Fred said, because the definition of fiduciary determines the applicability of the prohibited transaction rules in the tax code with respect to an IRA, if DOL expands the definition of conduct that is subject to the fiduciary standard, it has the effect in the IRA marketplace entirely outside of any plan context, just a straight IRA that's sold to an individual, bought by an individual, not in connection with a plan. Those prohibited transaction rules in the code apply to that. So if the advice that's being given to that IRA account holder is technically fiduciary under DOL's expanded definition, then the effect on an IRA account is that you have to be paid as if you're a fiduciary, even though you are not otherwise held to a fiduciary standard of conduct. So in other words, DOL is able, through this jurisdiction it has over the interpretation of the prohibited transaction rules in the code, it's able to dictate the payment arrangements for IRA accounts where investment advice is being provided. And that's something I think increasingly advisors are becoming aware of this, and of course I'm sure many of you on this call have always understood that. But that's a big issue. That's where the Department of Labor is not just looking at what happens in plans and how fiduciaries act in plans, but directly trying to regulate the IRA marketplace and how advice is provided there by reducing conflicts that they perceive to exist by virtue of how the payments are being received. So a quick example, if you're an advisor to an IRA account and you would get a different amount of compensation depending on what investments the participant, the owner of that IRA selected, then you would have a non-compliant, you would have a prohibited transaction in how you were being compensated, because there's a differential, you have a financial interest in the outcome. And so that's one area where DOL's reach on this is causing a great deal of controversy. And it's interesting, I think, to note that the White House has formally embraced this Department of Labor action. The president himself rolled it out at an event on February 23rd when this regulation was forwarded to OMB. What the White House is doing is saying we want the Labor Department to become, in many ways, the primary financial regulator for this IRA relationship outside of the plan relationship. Because, as Fred was saying, while the conduct of the various types of advisors are either regulated by securities laws or insurance laws or banking laws, this would have DOL setting the compensation rules for all of those different types of advisors, regardless of whatever type of regulation would otherwise apply to their conduct. So this is a pretty significant step in how they want to regulate this marketplace. The third issue, of course, deals with rollovers. How is it that the ERISA assets and plans make their way to the IRA marketplace? Who's providing advice? How are they being compensated and helping people with those rollover issues? And so what the White House has said and the Department of Labor has said is that they perceive a lot of conflicts that are to the detriment of participants in plans and to the holders of IRA accounts, because these compensation arrangements that are not currently subject to a fiduciary standard may result in advice being provided that benefits the advisor, but not the participant or the account holder. And so they've come up with some numbers that they believe illustrate this. The White House has said that they believe about $1.7 trillion in retirement assets, and they aren't necessarily breaking that down clearly between plans and IRAs, but cumulatively about $1.7 trillion in retirement assets is being advised in a way that they believe is conflicted. And that's the scope of this area in particular. They're looking to change the rules to reduce that. Now, as Fred was saying, the issue comes down to prohibited transaction exemptions. How is it that you say, okay, this would ordinarily be prohibited, but we will nonetheless allow certain conduct to continue if certain conditions are met? And one of the key issues we're all going to be looking for in this regulation when we see the proposal in the next couple months, whenever it ultimately comes out, is how did they define these exemptions? What are the conditions they put in place? Now, what they've said so far is that they're going to issue a new type of exemption that they say will be, quote, more principles-based, providing businesses with the flexibility to adopt practices that work for them and adapt those practices to changes that the regulators might anticipate, while ensuring the client's best interests are first and any conflicts are disclosed. So it's not clear, though, exactly what those principles might be that would construct that that exemption. And that's really where a great deal of the time and effort in looking at this regulation is going to be focused. And that's an issue that would apply both to IRA advice and to rollover advice as areas of particular interest. So in the rollover space, one of the big concerns that we're hearing from a lot of different advisors, financial service providers, and others is, well, how will this rollover situation work, given that in general, when you're in a plan, you're in an institutionally based pricing model, But when you're in an IRA, typically you're in a retail-based pricing model, and there's a legitimate reason for that. One of them is a group-based product where there isn't a lot of individual-level services. It's primarily an accumulation vehicle in a 401k plan, whereas when you're nearing the end of your career and deciding to roll over into an IRA and work with an advisor to develop a distribution plan for your assets, you're actually buying a different service than the service you were getting in the plan. That's inherently more individualized and requires a lot more direct attention and potentially different products and services that may not be available in the plan you're leaving. And so it appears the White House and the Department of Labor are in many ways implicitly acknowledging that there's a different purpose between the accumulation vehicle of the 401k plan and the distribution vehicle of the IRA and the planning associated with that. But the question is, how will they determine through these exemptions what's an inappropriate rollover, where these fees being charged are not in the best interest of participants, from one that they believe to be an appropriate rollover where they are? And that's where there's been a lot of speculation. Will it involve holding fees level from one to the other? Is that a practical approach? Would that restrict access to advice? These are all issues that people are speculating about. My own personal opinion, I'm very concerned that I think the fiduciary rules are a very blunt tool. Historically, they've not been a good way to address nuanced issues. And so I'm very concerned about what the proposal will look like. But in fairness to the Department of Labor and the White House, until we actually see the proposal and see how they've tried to address this issue, we're all spending a lot of time speculating as to what might be. Ultimately, it's going to depend on what is. And that's probably the quickest summary we can do of that issue at this point. Fred, what did I leave out that you think we ought to comment on?
Just a couple of things to add. One, that when we refer to the prohibited transaction rules, those aren't, the DOL didn't make those rules. Those are in the statute. They've been in Internal Revenue Code since 1975 and in ERISA since 1975, and they've applied to IRAs since 1975, as well as retirement plans. So the reason that this is subject to discussion now is not because the DOL is creating new prohibited transaction rules. Those have been around forever. Unfortunately, or fortunately, for IRAs, they were never enforced by the Internal Revenue Code, which is the only agency that can actually enforce them. So we've had these rules in effect for many years. I think they've largely been ignored because they aren't enforced. What's new is that the expansion of the definition of fiduciary advice would make more advisor services subject to those rules. So the rules have been there forever. It's just whether or not more advisors are going to, the whole issue is whether or not more advisors are going to be subject to the rules. So for example, RIAs who acknowledgingly, for the most part, are fiduciaries, have been subject to those IRA prohibited transaction rules since 1975. It's more the broker-dealer community that the concern is would be pulled in under the fiduciary definition and therefore subject to those rules.
And I would add also to that the insurance community, insurance agents in particular, are another group that I think might see this, feel that this applies differently than it has in the past.
Yeah, although most of them, Brad, in my experience, are also registered representatives of the broker-dealer that's affiliated with the insurance company, and therefore and when they sell variable products, they're actually operating under the supervision of the broker-dealer. But even if they don't sell variable products and they sell traditional insurance, there they would be operating as agents of the insurance company. For example, a traditional annuity contract, and then the question is, is that fiduciary advice? So, you know, I agree. I think the insurance companies, either because of their affiliated broker-dealer or because of sales of traditional insurance products, are also concerned about it. Those tend to be the two groups, the broker-dealers and the insurance companies. And I think there are three big issues, just picking up on what Brad said and reiterating it, where most of the fire seems to be burning. Issue number one, capturing of rollovers. Why? Well, because there are trillions of dollars that are going to be coming out of 401k plans and other qualified retirement plans over the next 5 or 10 years because of the aging of the baby boomers. And essentially, those assets are going from institutional pricing of retirement plans for their, where the participants are bubble-wrapped by plan fiduciaries into the retail world of IRAs. And the government concern is that there are going to be conflicts of interest and expensive, overly expensive products and services. And needless to say, the financial services community says, no, that's not the case, that that's an exaggeration. So that's the debate. So number one is rollovers. Number two, is, as Brad said, it's variable compensation. Can an advisor to an IRA make a recommendation for a product that pays the advisor more compensation and have that conflict, that obvious conflict of interest, be okay? Well, in my experience, most advisors are pretty good guys, and they're not succumbing to the conflict. The conflict is there. They're just not succumbing to it. But that's a concern. And then the third one is proprietary products, because under these rules, organizations get aggregated. So to the extent that a broker-dealer or a broker works for a broker-dealer that has affiliated mutual funds, the recommendation of those funds would be a prohibited transaction. So that's the third area. To me, those are the big three. And as Brad said, we'll be vitally interested in seeing what the prohibited, the so-called principles-based prohibited transaction says about that.
One more thing that I just want to point out, because another question I've gotten a lot from financial advisors and others is say, well, wait a minute, the SEC has said it's going to move forward with the requirements under Dodd-Frank to harmonize the fiduciary and suitability standards. What is the state of that, and what effect does that have on DOL's effort? And I think this is a very interesting question, because as I said before, the White House has effectively endorsed the DOL approach as a way to sort of comprehensively regulate this retirement space using the prohibited transaction rules. But the SEC is going forward with the Dodd-Frank harmonization, and that raises questions about, you know, which entity is doing what and how these rules will fit together. The agencies say they're coordinating. Congressional folks have raised questions about how effective is that coordination and to what degree, and we're still seeing a lot of interplay on those questions. But I do think it raises an interesting point, which is if the SEC moves forward, then you're regulating those securities channels, but that isn't necessarily comprehensive, because you would still have other channels of regulation that would be separate from the SEC effort. I think a big picture question here is DOL the right entity to do this comprehensively? Are the prohibited transaction rules the right way to go? Or is it better to look at this in segments by industry type, for example, the way the SEC is proceeding? And I think that's going to be an interesting question to see how Congress considers that once we see the proposal, once we see the comments come in to DOL's approach. Will Congress start having a preference for looking at this a different way? But I think there's a bigger debate to be had, and one that we will have, about really is DOL the right regulator, even if it has the authority to proceed, does it mean we want it to proceed relative to other regulators? I just think that's an interesting question we're going to hear a lot more about.
Yeah, two issues on that. One is I think ERISA would have to be amended, and the Internal Revenue Code would have to be amended, because right now the stuff is law, not regulation. The prohibited transaction rules are law. I think it may take a legislative answer rather than a regulatory answer, one issue. The other one is, I think Mary Jo White, as chairperson of the SEC, has said she's willing to move forward. But the two Republican commissioners have said that they're against the proposal. So Mary Jo White has to get the two Democratic commissioners on the same page to her and agree it's a common approach, and then they sort of have to force it on the two Republican commissioners. I don't know about how you feel about that, Brad, but I think the jury is still out on whether or not they're going to be able to do all that. Historically, I think the SEC has liked to move by consensus, and with the two Republican commissioners saying they're opposed to a fiduciary standard under the securities laws, I don't know if she can cobble together an alliance that agrees on a particular rule and get it through. And I would guess that would take a few years for that to happen, don't you think?
Well, I think that's certainly a fair question. I think the important distinction that's happened in the last, say, 2 months is Chair White has gone from saying this is an issue we ought to come to agreement on whether we're going to proceed, to now say this is an issue on which I want to proceed, and I'm now directing the staff to start giving us options. So yeah, I think you're correct that ultimately at least three commissioners are going to have to agree on what the answer to that question is. But I do think they've turned the corner in terms of their intent. It's no longer their intent to think about doing it. It's their intent to start doing it. Whether they achieve it would be the, you know, a different issue.
Yeah. Also, just to give you all a timeline of where I see this going, as I mentioned earlier, we think that the proposed package will come out somewhere towards late May. So let's call that the 1st of June, just for ease of conversation. When it comes out, there seems to be a consensus there's going to be a 90-day comment period. So we'll see it somewhere around the 1st of June, as will everybody else. And 90 days, then the comments. So that's June, July, and August. That gets us roughly to Labor Day. Then the DOL will take all those comments and pull them in and work on a final regulation, assuming they decide to proceed in that direction. And I suspect that with all the time and energy invested in it now and the politics invested in it, that they will. So that would be, and usually it takes 4, 5, 6 months, so that would be September, October, November, December, January.
So and they'll be holding administrative hearings as part of that process as well, so there'll be, you know, public hearings at the Labor Department as well as everything Congress might do with public hearings on the same issues.
Yeah, so they're about January, at the end of January, end of February, call it the 1st of March, that we would expect that the final package would be sent over to the Office of Management and Budget. Again, it's got to go through that same process. And that would take about 3 months. That's March, April, May. So about the 1st of June of 2016 is when the final regulations should emerge. It seems to me that the Department of Labor is going to have to give a deferred effective date, that they just can't say, here's the final regulation, everybody's got to comply tomorrow. My best guess would be that they would look at January 1, 2017 as the effective date. Now, part of my best guess is just that it's easy to start a new rule at the beginning of a new year. But even more importantly, part of my thinking is that they won't allow a deferred effective date that goes beyond the Obama administration leaving office at the end of January 2017. The reason being that the first thing that happens when a new president is sworn in, his chief of staff sends out a memo to all the administrative agencies saying, stop every regulation that isn't finalized yet. We want to review them in light of the philosophy of the new administration. And Brad, I think that actually happened to you a little bit, didn't it, with a couple of regulations you worked on?
Yeah, I actually have the distinction of publishing one of the first regulations of the Obama administration, which was immediately quashed. But on January 21st of 09, our investment advice regulation was published, and then it was ultimately rescinded by the incoming administration.
And then I think Phyllis was a part of that happening, and so she's certainly aware of that issue, as is, you know, we would assume the White House and Secretary Perez. So
yeah, basically the ballpark is they're under the Congressional Review Act, you have to have at least, the regulation has to be on, a regulation like this significant, has to be on the books for at least 60 days before it can go into effect. And so if it's been less than 60 days, the incoming administration can rescind it without doing a formal notice and comment amendment process. So ballpark, I tend to agree with your timeline, Fred. I think in ordinary course, that's the sort of timeline they would follow. Now, will that be what actually occurs? That's a whole different question. There's an awful lot of debate to be had between now and then. But their sort of deadline is they want to get this published by roughly October of 16 in order to ensure this becomes a regulation that has to be adhered to rather than one that gets potentially shoved to the side.
Yeah, and so I think we're in agreement that it's going to be roughly that timeline. And I think, Brad, that we pretty much end up in agreement that at least in terms of this package, and you know, not looking at the SEC, not looking at legislative hearings or proposals, but if you just focus on this package alone, that the key is going to be the principles-based exemption. That I think, I know. I think. I suspect you do. That the fiduciary regulation itself is going to be pretty similar to the withdrawn one, and that the relief that is going to be provided will be through the prohibited transaction exemptions. And the biggie is this principle-based concept, which is another way of saying what are the conditions going to be to get advantage, to take advantage of the exemption, and are they workable? Do you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. I think they will maintain a very broad definition of what makes you a fiduciary, both for purposes of plans and the prohibited transaction rules in the code. And so the net effect of that would be almost every advisor to a plan or an IRA would be a fiduciary. The question is, what's the effect of that, as you just said? So how do they write these PT rule exemptions, and what does that look like? This is where, you know, Fred, you may be a little more optimistic than I am. I'm a little more pessimistic that what we're going to see coming out of this will be very viable, but you know, let's wait until we see it and then make our decision. But I'm not terribly optimistic, just given the history of the prohibited transaction rules. I mean, I point to the 2011 final rule that was put out on investment advice implementing the PPA provision. Even after that quote-unquote liberalization of the PT rules, DOL's own economic analysis estimates that $100 billion a year is lost by participants due to lack of access to investment advice, due to mistakes that they make because they don't get investment advice. And I think that's a problem that illustrates why the prohibited transaction rules are not an ideal tool to do this. That said, I admit, let's wait and see what happens before we judge it.
Yeah, and you know, when Brad says that I'm probably a little more optimistic than he is, maybe the better word is hopeful. What I mean by that, or what I think Brad means by that, certainly my thinking, which Brad knows, is that the, or my hope is that the Department of Labor will make it a disclosure-based exemption, such that with adequate disclosure, and not just, there's so much disclosure out there that just more disclosure isn't going to do any good, but effective, concise disclosure that makes sense in the words of the average participant. If it's done that way, it might be workable. That's really sort of what I'm looking for. But as Brad says, we don't know. At this point, you know, we know it's principles-based. We know the prohibited transaction exemptions always have conditions. But that's about where it ends up. So we will have to wait and see. And by the time we do our next conference call, the rule should be out. So we're going to have some fun next time. Brad, let's drop it there. And I know you spent time thinking about and looking at the various legislative proposals that are in Congress right now. Why don't you bring us up to speed with where things are?
Sure. So, you know, we've been talking for quite a while now. Everyone's been talking for a while now about, you know, what's Congress going to do to change the tax code when they debate comprehensive tax reform? What implications is that going to have on treatment of tax treatment of retirement plans? And there have been a lot of proposals out there to address this in various ways. One of the big questions is, what's the timing or likelihood of comprehensive tax reform? And what's been happening this last couple of weeks is we're hearing from the administration that they want to look at corporate tax reform, sort of the business side of tax first, rather than looking at some of the other issues. And it's not 100% clear how retirement issues might factor into that. You know, there's a lot of big picture tax issues that are being debated in terms of, you know, how is offshore corporate income taxed and all those kinds of questions. And on that area, the Republicans in the House, Chairman Ryan of the Ways and Means Committee and Secretary Liu, they're all discussing moving very quickly and trying to come to some kind of agreement this summer, but it sounds like that wouldn't necessarily be much more broad. So we don't really know exactly what the timing is. I would guess that we're looking at probably a longer-term project for any sort of broad-based tax reform, which is probably where the most significant changes would come to the tax treatment of plans. And there have been a lot of issues raised about how does Congress get some revenue out of the retirement system to use for other purposes. So even on the Republican side, there have been proposals to do things like, limit the, freeze the inflationary growth on the contribution limits for 10 years so that they don't get any larger, looking at dividing how the contributions to retirement plans are made. So say the first half of the limit, the personal contribution limit of $18,500, would be pre-tax, the second half might be Roth only, There's just all sorts of proposals out there. Of course, President Obama reiterated his proposal in this latest 2016 budget that there be an absolute cap on the amount that can be saved in defined contribution plans of various types. It's often called the $3.4 million cap. The amount would actually vary with interest rates and other factors, so as, you know, as critics of it have said, that cap would actually be potentially quite lower in a higher interest rate environment. All of those issues out there go to trying to contain the degree of money the government is not receiving in revenue because of the incentives it's provided for the retirement system. And we're just looking, I think, at a fairly long, drawn-out fight on where some of that goes. In the meantime, what we've seen are the states being very proactive in trying to set up state-based retirement plans that are open to private sector employers or participants. And to that end, the Obama administration in the 2016 budget had what I think is actually a very significant change in policy. And if we weren't talking about the fiduciary rule as much, we'd probably spend more time talking about this. But in the budget proposal, the Obama administration asked for $6.5 million for the Department of Labor, as well as the authority to grant waivers to ERISA, preemption, to allow states to develop these proposals. Most of the states, such as California and Illinois, who are going fairly far down this path, have indicated that they don't want these state-based programs to be subject to ERISA. They want to structure them in a way that they're not ERISA covered. And so the proposal in the Obama administration's budget this year would say, we'll give the Department of Labor the authority to work with the states to approve waivers to ERISA to ensure that that doesn't happen, with the goal of fostering these states to try more and different approaches to expand coverage of retirement benefits. That's a really significant policy change from, you know, anytime a federal agency or the federal government tries to give up jurisdiction and cede it back to the states, that's worth taking note of and decide whether that's something that's good or bad. But I thought that was a particularly interesting development in the most recent budget. We could spend time going through all the different proposals. I don't know that there's a whole lot of utility to that because at this point, you know, where anyone's going to end up is, and when that might occur is still very much up in the air. Suffice it to say that in the Senate, Senator Hatch has put forward a series of reforms that I think are much more amenable to the financial services industry than some of the proposals from others in the Senate, but there's a lot of work yet to be done. The committees, however, are committed to actually working on it. So what we are seeing is Congress trying to move forward in a way that actually is aimed at getting to a bill. It's just not clear how long that'll take.
So it's an open question?
As with so many things with Congress, it is. But I do think the significant difference is that Congress actually is trying through the normal kind of committee and cooperative process, what used to be the normal committee and cooperative process, to develop legislation. What's less clear is what the Obama administration's role in that might be ultimately beyond some of these shorter-term business-related reforms that there does seem to be more agreement on.
Yeah, I think, Brad, that you've told me something along the lines of that retirement issues in Congress seems to be one of those areas that where the congressmen are taking more of a pragmatic approach and less of a philosophical battle. Did I get that right, or did I remember correctly?
No, I think that is correct. Congress, frankly, is very schizophrenic on their goals in this. On the one hand, they want to expand access. Almost everyone across the board, regardless of party, is troubled by the notion that there is some significant fraction of workers who don't have access to workplace retirement savings. At the same time, almost everyone in Congress understands there's limited revenue and wants to use some of the revenue in the retirement area for other purposes. And those are fundamentally opposing goals. But how that gets sorted out then becomes the issue.
Does that mean there's actually some risk to retirement plans if legislation proceeds?
Absolutely there is. It depends on what Congress decides to do. I mean, I think we can all point to examples in recent history where Congress has changed the tax treatment, but it didn't really hurt anything. For example, the expansion of Roth that occurred, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, whenever it was. Congress came up with, I think it was $20 billion, they believe that raised in money that they could use for other things. But I don't think anyone thinks that expanding how Roth worked really, you know, harmed anyone. That isn't necessarily the case. If they were to about going forward, if, for example, they were to, you know, reduce the amount you can contribute or means test it in such a way that small business owners weren't able to participate fully in the 401k even after, you know, making some of the changes they have to make now to be able to do that, that could really affect the availability of plans to rank and file workers. You know, there's a reason the tax incentives are there and take advantage of the business owner's own personal interests in retirement savings to link the needs of the workers and the owners in offering qualified plans. And if we make reforms in the interest of raising revenue that de-link those or reduce the linkage, then you'll have, I think, a net effect of fewer plans available. And that isn't what Congress intends, but the risk is that's the kind of thing they could achieve depending on which of 1,000 different ways they go forward in trying to raise some revenue.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We've got a few minutes before we'll open it up to questions and answers. So let me talk a little bit about the case of Tibble versus Edison International. And there are two distinct issues in that case. And in many of the media reports, those just get mushed together and don't get discussed separately. There is the substantive issue, which involves share classes. And in the specific case of Tibble versus Edison International, the trial court found that the plan fiduciaries could have, if they'd only asked for them, and in effect created a duty to ask, they could have had institutional share classes rather than retail share classes in a $1 billion-plus plan. And so that's why Tibble is out of the Edison International case was thought of as being a share class case. Well, the trial court ruled in favor of the participants, the plaintiffs, on that particular issue. It was appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit upheld the trial court decision. It's over and done with. The law, at least in the Ninth Circuit, in the western part of the United States, and since this opinion seems to make some sense, I would assume it'll be considered as being a national rule, is that there is a duty to look and see if other share classes are available that would be better for the plan. And I'm going to explain in a minute what I mean by better for the plan. But in this case, it was just retail versus institutional, and the trial court held and the Court of Appeals affirmed that there was a duty to investigate, and in that case, they should have purchased the institutional share classes for the plan. I think that opinion is bigger than just share classes, though, because if you get to group annuity contracts, for example, they have separate account classes or separate account share classes, if you will, meaning that there may be 10 or 15 different expense structures inside each separate account. And in essence, what the courts held was that where you can purchase the identical same investment for less money and you purchase it for more money, in other words, the retail versus the institutional, that is a wasting of participant money and a fiduciary breach. Well, that concept applies to separate account classes, share classes, and it's even conceivable at some point in the future it could apply to mutual funds versus collective trusts and so on. That's not clear yet, don't get me wrong, but it's possible. So that's what that's that share class part of the case. Well, what went to the Supreme Court if that was fully decided in the Ninth Circuit? Well, the issue before the trial court also held, and the Ninth Circuit also affirmed, a part of the case in favor of the fiduciaries. What they said was there were six mutual funds involved in the litigation, and the claim was the same for all of them. They should have been institutional rather than retail. Three of those had been selected within 6 years of the filing of the lawsuit, so they were within the six-year statute of limitations. Those three were the three that the plaintiffs won on. There were another three that had been selected more than 6 years before the lawsuit was filed, and the fiduciaries argued, wait a second, the statute of limitations is run. We can't be sued on that. The participants' attorneys, the plaintiffs, then argued, okay, maybe we can't sue you on the original selection, but there's a separate duty to monitor and we're going to sue you for the 6 open years of excess expenses under the duty to monitor rather than the duty to prudently select. The trial court said, no, that doesn't work. You know, that monitoring is a subset of the original selection, therefore we're going to look at the selection date. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, sort of. And what they said was, unless there's been a significant change, then you'll look back to the original selection date, and you only have to monitor if there's been a significant change. Well, the case, that's the issue that went up to the Supreme Court. There are 3 ways of looking at that. One, is there a duty to monitor every year, such that every year a new 6-year statute of limitations begun? 2, is there a duty to monitor only if there's been a significant change, in which case there would only be a new 6-year statute if there's been a significant change? Or 3, does the original selection date always prevail? The people who actually went to the Supreme Court hearing and listened to the arguments and watched the responses of the Supreme Court justices are handicapping the case as being that the Supreme Court, or at least a majority of the members of the Supreme Court, will rule that there is always a duty to monitor and every year a new 6-year statute begins, or something close to that, and then refer it back to the trial court to polish their decision in terms of applying it to the facts. Handicapping what the Supreme Court's going to do is like betting on greyhounds. I mean, it's really, really hard. So I think on that one, we're just going to have to wait and see, and we won't know the outcome until the Supreme Court rules, which should be in June. So we should get a decision from the Supreme Court in June, and the best bet is that the court will decide that there's a duty to monitor every year, regardless of whether there's been a significant change or not. Brad, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I just think this is an interesting example of how what's ostensibly a fight about the rules by which we sue each other actually is spilling over into the underlying policy itself. I mean, how the Supreme Court resolves this, if, for example, they take that middle course or some variation of the middle course that the Ninth Circuit was endorsing, where, you know, there has to have been, in effect, some kind of material change to reset the statute of limitations. You know, the fact that what you can or can't sue for is going to, in many ways, dictate the policy, because at the end of the day, without a remedy, how are people going to behave? It's just a very interesting case. I think there's the potential for this to come out with the Supreme Court with a decision that asks more new questions than it actually answers, and could be the beginning of a whole new strain of litigation on these issues.
Yeah, I think that's entirely possible. That a middle of the road decision would cause more litigation rather than resolve litigation. Also, I said earlier I would add something to this about the share classes. There are a number of reported cases out there where the courts have held that it's okay for plan sponsors to use revenue sharing, you know, 12b1 fees, subtransfer agency fees, shareholder servicing fees, and so on, to pay for plan services, for example, advisors or record keepers. And so revenue sharing alone isn't bad. I mean, I don't know why in the Tibble case they didn't argue, wait a second, we were getting revenue sharing from those retail share classes and they were helping carry the cost of the plan. That is perfectly permissible. And I don't think there's any dispute about that. The dispute about revenue sharing right now, or the concern rather about revenue sharing, is what happens if only some funds in a plan are paying revenue sharing. Let's say one half of the mutual funds in the plan are paying revenue sharing. The other half of the mutual funds are not. There's a company stock fund that is not, and there are individual brokerage accounts that are not. In other words, less than one half of the participants invested in one half of the funds are paying for everybody else to be in the plan, and they're carrying the whole plan on their backs. That's an allocation issue. It's not, is it wrong to have revenue sharing, but is the issue there is, are the fiduciaries prudently allocating the revenue sharing by paying the plan costs off the backs of a limited number of participants? That's an unresolved issue, but there's a lot of worry that it could potentially someday lead to litigation. Brad, I know you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think particularly when you're getting into larger plans, I think it's a fiduciary risk that would be a very attractive fact pattern to a plaintiff's attorney, to be able to go in and say, well, you know, it's interesting. All your highly comped employees are in brokerage windows paying no record-keeping costs, while all of your rank-and-file workers are paying all the record-keeping costs, including for the highly comped folks. That's the kind of fact pattern and potential class action lawsuit that would be unpleasant to have to defend against. We don't have a lot of guidance yet from DOL other than that it is a fiduciary issue, how you allocate, and that pro rata is usually an appropriate way, but some fixed administrative expenses like record keeping can be done per capita. So this is an area where I really think what's driving change here is concern about litigation more so than impending regulation. But there is the potential that DOL might address some of these issues in guidance on brokerage windows, which they did an RFI on brokerage window issues last year. So we may see guidance coming out on that at some point. But at this point, it strikes me as that this is one of those potential areas of litigation that it behooves us to think about and determine whether the way we're doing things is more or less risky than it ought to be.
Thanks, Brad. Operator, I think this is a good time to open it up for questions. You want to open up the lines?
Absolutely. If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to let your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Again, it is star 1 to be placed into queue.
Well, we're waiting for the first call. I would just add to what Brad said, that an issue nobody is really talking about yet is the allocation of revenue sharing a benefit rider feature under the Internal Revenue Code? If so, if it's allocated in a way that's discriminatory in favor of the highly compensated employees, for example, the examples that both Brad and I used for the HCEs are in brokerage accounts and not paying for the plan, that could be a tax qualification issue under 401A4 of the Internal Revenue Code as discriminatory. So nobody's talking about that. I don't think the IRS is aware of it, although there are 20 people from the IRS on the call today. No, I'm just kidding. So it's not just a DOL issue. There's also sort of a hidden tax qualification issue there. Operator?
And we'll take our first questioner.
Yeah, Jim Nolan. I was wondering, there was an article, I think, in yesterday's Wall Street Journal about combining a VAT tax with corporate tax return reform and how, and my personal thing is how that might affect retirement plans. Do you guys, have you heard anything more about anything like that?
Brad, I think this is stuff you followed up on more than me.
Yeah, I haven't heard exactly, and I haven't heard the speculation about that get to the point of saying, okay, and how would this affect our tax treatment of plans? But certainly that's an issue that they've been talking about in a broader corporate tax context. I think Congress is probably a long ways from approving a VAT tax at this point. While there's folks on the left and right who both like it, I think there's a lot of people in the middle who are very concerned about how easy it is to, it's through fairly small changes, ratchet up the incremental tax rate. And so I think there's just a lot of potential concern and resistance to going that route. But I certainly haven't heard anyone get to the point of saying, okay, if we did this and now we shifted a bunch of revenue, how would we apply this, or how would this affect the taxation of retirement plans? I just don't think people are that far in the debate yet.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next caller, please go ahead.
Yes, I have
Hello.
A question. When do you expect the DOL will be putting out information on the RFI on the self-directed brokerage account?
Brad?
Well, I've talked to some folks at DOL about that recently, and they seem to be very consumed by this fiduciary regulation, as well as a couple other things they're working on. It doesn't seem to be on the front burner. So I'm not expecting that to be a short-term issue, but I do think there's some things there that they are interested and intrigued by based on the responses they got to the RFI. So if I were to guess, I'd say we could see guidance coming along maybe in 16, but it's looking unlikely to be in 15 just given the amount of resources they're having to devote to the fiduciary role.
Okay.
Yeah, just so you know, Brad and I have talked about this, and because of Brad's experience at the Department of Labor, he understands the processes there intimately well. And Brad's belief, which makes a lot of sense to me, is that they're going to issue soft guidance. And what we mean by soft guidance is something similar to what you may remember from a year or two ago, the tips on target date funds,
mm-hmm.
where it's more like a release of some kind. Because at this point, we both believe there really isn't enough time for the Department of Labor to start a whole new regulatory project, go through the proposal and the hearings and the final and the OMB and all of that, and get it done before Obama leaves office. So, Brad, do you think, did I accurately state our conversation?
You stated that very well, and my general view is the closer we get to the end of the administration, say, you know, the latter part, latter two-thirds, latter half of 2016, the more we're going to see this kind of soft guidance come out at an increasing pace. And as Fred said, by soft guidance, if you think back to the tips for fiduciaries on selecting target date funds, truly DOL just issued a press release saying, here's what we think. That doesn't have any value legally other than just persuasive value. It's not something that binds anyone to particular behavior. But nonetheless, it was very influential and is something that has been widely incorporated into the fiduciary process of a lot of folks for selecting target date funds because of its persuasive authority. So they can do a lot with this kind of guidance, and they need relatively little clearance to come out with these things. So when they do decide to move and start issuing guidance, and I think, again, towards the end of the administration, we'll probably see a much faster pace for this as they try to get their views out before the clock runs down. We'll see a lot of that kind of approach. And I think the RFI for brokerage windows had a lot of issues in it that would be interesting to DOL when they have the time to work on it.
Mm-hmm. And I think also Brad and I agree on that there's at least two thoughts coming out of that we think will be there. One is a statement consistent with what the DOL has said many, many times, that the plan fiduciaries have to prudently select and monitor the broker-dealer and providing the brokerage account, including the services and the costs and so on. In the small plan world particularly, I think many plan sponsors have viewed the brokerage accounts as sort of personal investment playgrounds for the partners, and they may not have any information at all about the brokerage accounts. So that's one issue, prudent selection and monitoring. And I think that one's almost a slam dunk that'll be in there if they issue anything. The other is, I think, one of the areas of great concern is where everybody in the plan is put into a brokerage account, and there is no lineup of core investment alternatives. So I think you could see something that requires more of that arrangement. And I say this just so that going forward, you're not anybody you advise now, at least they're aware that that's going to be happening or could be happening in the future. Brad, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, that last issue you mentioned where someone sets up a plan that's all brokerage windows and no core menu, no designated investment alternatives, DOL's concern about that is that it's avoiding the participant disclosure requirements. Their theory behind the 4045 rule, the disclosure requirements to participants from the plan, is that participants have now got the obligation to make investment decisions, and therefore there's a corresponding fiduciary duty by the plan to give them the information with which to make those decisions. And a brokerage window-only plan design only discloses how a service works. It doesn't provide any investment-related information. And so DOL is very troubled by that approach, and they've in the past raised concerns about it. And I agree with Fred. I think there's a likelihood that that's something they'll address in more detail.
Operator, we're at the hour, but we'll take one or two more questions if there are any.
Next caller, please go ahead.
Gentlemen, this is Rob Smith. First of all, kudos to you, Fred, for bringing the subject of allocation of plan fees and revenue sharing to the forefront. I believe this is a big issue. In fact, if I wore a younger man's clothes, I would think about getting into litigation specifically for this reason. I believe it's an issue that's going to come to forefront, especially professional-type plans, such as physician groups and engineers and things like that. So just kudos for keeping that in front of people and making it an issue. Secondly, one of the things I'd like to have you talk a little bit more, we glossed over a little bit the state-sponsored retirement plans, talked about IRAs, but I'm not only concerned about IRAs at state level, but also very concerned about states getting involved with MEPs. And ironically, it's the states that probably are the least fiduciary responsible states that are getting involved with. I'm very concerned about that. I'd just like to have you maybe expound on that a little bit more. Thanks.
Hey, Brad.
No, I absolutely share those concerns. I think it's you know, while I'm a conservative by my political philosophy and I'm a big believer in the 10th Amendment and states' rights and all that, I don't think balkanizing the retirement regulatory landscape is a good idea. And I have a lot of concerns, as you do, about what different states might do. I mean, to what extent would states set up, you know, because the states would be, in essence, controlling the fees and the investments that would be available through these state programs. What stops the state from having its own debt instruments be the investments? And, you know, we all know how well that's worked out for the investments for state employees and municipal employees and a variety of those kinds of plans. I think there's a lot of concerns about how good a job would states do. Is this something states should be getting into, or should this remain a federal issue, as it has been with ERISA preemption since at least 1974? So I think you're right that there are some real concerns there. Most of the states appear to be approaching this to try to set up a payroll deduction IRA and have it not be, again, an ERISA plan. Yeah, but I think there's some very valid concerns as to whether this is a good or bad idea writ large. At the same time, it highlights the fundamental issue, which is coverage. You know, the states are getting into this space because there is a hole. There is not sufficient coverage of all workers. Now, you can question, you know, how economically feasible is it to get there. But, for example, the federal government has debated for a while, and the House and Senate actually 2 or 3 years ago passed different bills, but they never reconciled them, to have a payroll deduction IRA available on federal terms. And I think there's an idea there that would probably work better. You'd get economies of scale. You'd have uniform administration across 50 states and the territories. I think that would be an approach that would be better to addressing folks who aren't going to get an employer-provided retirement plan than having the state set off in a bunch of different directions.
Operator, let's take one more question, and then we'll call it a day.
We do have another questioner in queue. Caller, please go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question about the implementation of the fiduciary rules at the IRA level as prohibited transactions. My recollection is under the code is that a prohibited transaction results in the entire IRA being taxable. Do these rules take a different approach potentially for the consequences of a prohibited transaction with an IRA?
Now my recollection on that is that if it's a prohibited transaction by the IRA owner, then it causes the entire IRA to be disqualified. But if it's a prohibited transaction by a service provider, it is a an excise tax on the service provider to, you know, restore any money they made to the plan. And if they don't, plus an excise tax, and if they don't, then 100% excise tax, and I mean, just terrible, terrible consequences.
Sure.
But no, I don't think if it's a service provider prohibited transaction that it results in the entire IRA being disqualified.
I mean,
recollection. Let me be fair with her. I mean, let me be honest. I haven't looked at that recently, so that's just recall.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see then how that plays out when these rules come out as to how that kind of a prohibited transaction follows them. And I have heard from time to time folks talk about making a change in that IRS rule even for the account holder. In the workaround that folks do that are concerned about that is to say have a separate IRA if you have an investment that you feel has any risk associated with it. That just comes to mind with that discussion. So thank you for the insight.
Sure. And it also highlights an important issue, which is DOL, under the reorganization plan where they divided all this up back in the late 70s, DOL has interpretive authority over these rules, but as Fred said, the IRS retains the enforcement authority. And there have been a number of reports suggesting that the IRS is having difficulty regulating sort of the basic requirements of IRAs right now in terms of excess contributions and all those kinds of issues. So there is, I think, a fair point to say, which is if this is the mechanism by which we're going to regulate the large bulk, probably $14 to $15 trillion of, well, about $7.3 trillion in IRAs, you know, is there the enforcement mechanism to match the interpretive mechanism that DOL would put in place? And I think that's a fair criticism.
Well, everybody, that concludes the formal part of the program, but Jim, let me turn it over to you to talk about the next program and when we're going to have it.
Certainly, Fred. Thanks so much. And Brad, thank you for the participation today. And thank you for everyone who joined us for the call. Please mark your calendars for June 16th. That will be our next quarterly call. Should be exciting as we may have an opportunity to discuss the DOL and their proposed regulations. So again, thanks for calling in.
Is there a duty to monitor only if there's been a significant change, in which case there would only be a new six-year statute if there's been a significant change? Or three, does the original selection date always prevail? The people who actually